Hello and welcome to the Champions for Social Good podcast, the podcast for people dedicated to social impact. I'm Jamie Serino, Director of Marketing with the Corporations and Foundations Division of Blackpod. I'm here today with Emily Corey Pryor, Executive Director of Data2X, which is housed at the UN Foundation. Welcome, Emily.
Thank you so much, Jamie. Happy to be here.
Yeah, we're really happy to have you on the show. Can you tell us a little bit about yourself and about Data2X?
Sure. So my name is Emily Pryor, as you said, and I'm proud to be the Executive Director of Data2X. I started with Data2X really when we first initiated the program, and it's really been an honor to grow it and to see it develop over the years. Before I was running Data2X, I also managed our research program on women's economic empowerment, which was also based at the UN Foundation. And I worked as a senior advisor on the startup team for Girl Up, which is a campaign that listeners might be familiar with. It's a For Girls, By Girls campaign that's based at the UN Foundation. I've also spent some time in the private sector working for a biotech firm named Gilead Sciences, and also started my career at the American Red Cross headquarters in Washington, D.C.
That's great. Really impressive background. Can you tell us a little bit about Data2X?
Absolutely. So Data2X is a collaborative technical and advocacy platform that focuses on gender data specifically. And in more detail, we focus on improving the quality and the availability and the use of gender data in order to make a practical difference in the lives of women and girls. So we are working with UN agencies and multilateral agencies, with governments and civil society, academia, and the private sector to identify gender data gaps and work to close those gender data gaps. And then hopefully, at the end of the day, use that gender data to improve policies and decision-making in support of gender equality.
So can you tell us a little bit about, you know, what you mean exactly when you say gender data?
Sure, absolutely. That's a great question, an important question. So gender data there's two aspects to gender data. First is it means data that is disaggregated by sex. Understanding what primary school enrollment rates, for instance, look like for girls versus boys. But it doesn't just end there. It's also data that pertains specifically to girls and women, such as maternal mortality rates. So just from a biological standpoint, that's not going to pertain to, you know, young men or men in the same way that it would for girls and women. So it also means something, you know, deeper in addition to some of these definitions about, you know, sex and specific aspects of biology. It also refers to something deeper, which is really the question of what kinds of data get collected and aspects of data collection that can be gendered or might lend themselves to bias in some way. And I think that's a really important element of what gender data and, you know, our push for greater gender data is all about.
Yeah, can you tell us, you know, how we ended up, you know, in the place that we're at now? You know, how has data become biased?
So I think it's important to know, you know, with all data collection, and I'm sure many of your listeners are experienced development practitioners and work with data every day in their lives, data is a part of a community, and it's a part of a culture. And people who design surveys, who carry out surveys, who analyze results, who report results, who use results, you know, we're all part of a broader culture. And I think that what can happen and what has happened over time is that that contributes to and the various processes that we have for data collection and analysis and use are informed by our own understanding and the structure within which we live. And so as a result of that, there are situations where we simply either don't have any data at all about women and girls and boys and men, both independently but also in relation to each other, or we have you know, bad data, what we call bad data about mm-hmm. about women and girls. And we're really focused on both of those things, on identifying what those gaps are, highlighting the fact that this is a problem, that these exist, and educating people about what gender data is in the first place. And then, very importantly, trying to figure out how we close those gender data gaps and how we encourage more use of good gender data for making better policies.
Mm. Do you have any examples of, you know, where data might be biased or data might be missing for certain things?
Sure, absolutely. There are many examples. You know, one of the things we first did when we started Data2X in 2012 was really set out to identify what the global gender data gaps were. And we did that by looking mm-hmm. across sectors. So we looked at health and education, economic participation, political participation, and human security. And we looked across all of those sectors and identified that there were 28 global gender data gaps that existed. So, you know, that information is available on our website. We have it in an easy to digest table form. So would encourage people to check that out because it's kind of a helpful crib sheet for understanding this challenge. But, you know, in terms of some specifics, in terms of both this either having bad data or having no data at all, some of the examples of this would be things like measurement biases that reinforce gender stereotypes. And one area where this is particularly prevalent is in the area of economic participation. And if you look at the table that we've put together on these 28 gaps, you'll see that that's one of the areas, economic participation is one of the areas where there are the most gaps. And that's because historically, you know, women haven't been defined or looked at as a part of the, you know, formal economy and as a part of the economic participation question when we're designing things like labor surveys. And so when you have that situation, you know, and especially in many countries, the way that a survey might be designed or who is asked the survey questions or the way in which women actually participate in the economy is not easily captured by existing surveys. So, for instance, you know, many women in many countries, especially more, you know, resource-constrained settings, are engaged in more seasonal work or less stable forms of employment, let's say in agriculture, seasonal work in agriculture. And a lot of labor surveys might break down, you know, whether or not you're employed or not as either you're formally employed, right? So you have a job that you go to every day or, you know, you're not. And so it can be actually quite difficult to find data and have good, accurate data on how women are participating in the economy or not. A lot of times that can be obscured in the data that's collected because women's participation in the economy can be, especially in many places, very, you know, complex. Women will do a variety of ways of participating in the economy. Some that might be goods that are for sale, but some are ways in which a woman is contributing to the economy, but her work is unpaid. So mm-hmm. it's unpaid work on a family farm or in a family business, or it's work in the home caring for children or for the elderly. And that those kinds of questions and that kind of information about women's participation in economies is often missing from the ways that data is collected and analyzed and then used.
Yeah, I think it's fascinating to look at that. I think, you know, a lot of people don't realize that as they're looking at statistics like that. So what kinds of things does your group do to try to fix that? It seems quite complex and complicated. So what kind of measures do you put into place?
Yeah, it absolutely is complex. There's certainly this isn't, you know, new information. There have been many people for many years who have certainly been aware of this challenge and wanting, you know, to work together to address it and change it. And I think that's why it's frankly really exciting that there has been a groundswell of support really building for gender data. I think we have more and more people paying attention to it and frankly stopping and listening long enough to understand, wait a second, you know, I always thought that labor statistics you know, I didn't really think about how labor statistics were collected
and
whether or not women were represented. And now I'm stopping and thinking about it, right? So that's one area of tremendous progress and something that we've been really involved and engaged in trying to make that happen. So that's one area that I think is really encouraging. Other things, you know, that we are doing, and we are only one part of this, certainly, but you know, we really felt that it wasn't enough to just identify gaps or even educate people on what those gaps were and get the word out there, but also work on how we could forge partnerships with the agencies that are the big data producers and data collectors to try to encourage and accelerate, you know, advances on this. And so one of our partnerships is looking at this issue of how women's work and women's employment are captured in labor force surveys. And this is a partnership that is with the International Labor Organization and with the World Bank and with the Food and Agriculture Organization. So these are all large multilateral agencies. And it really was about working with all three of those agencies, getting them all, you know, working together to really collaborate on how do you ask those questions. You know, this is a mix of kind of very deep technical work, but also needing to be able to translate that work for why it matters ultimately. So, you know, on the deep technical side, you know, you have to think about when you're carrying out a labor force survey, every country is different, every context is different. But you also have to think about things like, what is the ordering of the questions? How are people going to interpret or see themselves in the way that a question is worded? And then that's going to affect how they answer that question, right? So there are a lot of, you know, very, very technical kind of challenges, and exciting challenges if you're a statistics person, in terms of how you effectively get this work done. And, you know, there are wonderful people who are working really hard on this issue. But then there's this additional step, which is how do you ensure that there is the will, there's the political will, that energy and resources is invested in figuring this out in the first place. So saying, no, it's really important that we get this right so we ensure that women are adequately represented in our labor force information. And then it's the how do we use that data that we get to make a change in the way that policies are made. So if we have a better idea of how women are participating in the economy or how they are not participating or how they are excluded from the economy, how do we build policies that better enable that participation? And that's a whole chain of events that are both technical, communications, and advocacy in nature.
Right. And so you brought up, you know, political obstacles, and, you know, I imagine it's very difficult, you know, maybe working country to country, as you were saying. So what kind of roadblocks do you find, and how do you overcome them maybe when you're, so, you know, let's say a country's measuring education, but they don't even allow their women to be educated, you know, and so that's a political situation. So how do you, you know, what are those encounters like, and how do you overcome those?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, you brought up education, Jamie, and I think that's a great example because it's actually an example of where gender data has been a powerful engine of change, I would say. So, you know, in the early, I'm sure you remember, I certainly do, although I'm dating myself, but when the MDGs, the Millennium Development Goals were getting started, one of the areas where that was very definitively focused on a gender equality topic was on education and on primary education and increasing parity in education between boys and girls. But the reason that was able to be a goal that was stated and then measured, right? So you wouldn't want to it's hard to put a goal out there if you aren't really sure how you're going to measure progress on a
goal. Right.
But a reason why that was able to be articulated and to be followed up on as a Millennium Development Goal was because the data existed, right? There had been a realization several years earlier that you know, data needed to be collected by not only just in general having global rates of primary school enrollment, but that it needed to be disaggregated by sex so that you could see, you know, oh, wait a second, you know, there's actually in this country, you know, or in this region, you know, it's 80% of boys being educated versus 20% of girls, let's say, just as an example. And so the ability, the fact that that data existed then allowed for there to be a global commitment to increasing parity in primary school enrollment, which, of course, is what we have seen. We're not there yet on secondary school enrollment, but the fact that we've made so much progress on primary school is really exciting. So, you know, I think that's just a great example that I love to praise the education community for in the first place, but also kind of use that as an example for why I think gender data is really so important. I think, you know, in terms of your question about how you deal with what some of those political barriers can be, I mean, they're certainly real. My take on that is that having the information and pushing for the information oftentimes gives the tools that are needed in order to do something about the problem, right? So I think it's important to continue to push for the information, even if political barriers, you know, do exist. I think if you don't push for the information in the first place, then, you know, you don't have the data or the evidence to pinpoint the problem and get others talking about it within a given context. So this is where, you know, this issue of gender data is not something that's only within the domain of the data scientists and the statisticians, although they are critically important and a group that we are really trying to influence and see as a major audience for our work. But also this is where, you know, civil society gets involved, academia gets involved, policymakers get involved. And, you know, one area where there's actually been what I think is a really interesting example that, you know, kind of talks about how all of these different types of players come together is that, you know, we were talking earlier about how understanding how women, you know, spend their time when we're talking about things like labor force surveys, especially in places where perhaps there's not as much of an interest in understanding how women spend their time economically. There's and how we really categorize, you know, women's more traditional economic activities that are paid, you know, versus other activities that have important economic and societal values but are unpaid. Well, there's a really interesting example that we've just been learning about in Uruguay, where civil society and academia and policymakers, you know, knew that there was a gender inequity in terms of unpaid work, and that was therefore impacting women's ability to participate in the formal economy. But there wasn't really any way to prove that, right? The data wasn't necessarily there to tell that story. Everybody kind of knew it to be true, but didn't have the data to tell that story. And so, and therefore, there really wasn't a policy imperative to act. And so what they did was, you know, academia got involved and they developed and implemented what's called a time use survey, which essentially tries to understand how people are spending their time. And the National University launched it in 2003. And then, you know, basically that data collection, you know, continued through 2013. And then utilizing all of that data, civil society and academia were able to work together to show, they then had the numbers to back up that there was a care deficit and that women were spending, you know, a disproportionate amount of their time in unpaid work compared to men, and that this was affecting their ability to participate in the economy. And so they were able to use this information to then push policymakers to put it on the national policy agenda. So then Uruguay passed the national care policy in 2015 that focuses on care for, you know, for children, for the elderly, and for people with disabilities. And that's a really big deal. And it's a really interesting, I think, a really interesting example of how you get different communities working together, using, you know, advocating collecting the data in the first place and then using and advocating with that data to try to drive a policy change. We don't know yet. I mean, this policy was just enacted, I think it was at the end of 2015, so we, you know, can't point to results yet. But one of the goals, of course, is to try to improve, you know, the availability of care services to encourage and enable women to participate more in the formal economy. It's something we're going to definitely be keeping our eye on.
Yeah, that's a great example. I think that really ties it all together. So Data2X's role, is it one of, you know, education and advocacy, or are you, you know, providing sort of survey tools or doing, you know, your own surveying, or, you know, I just want to better understand, you know, your role within something like what you just described, or just in general as you try to, you know, fix this inequality issue.
Sure. So we work as both on the technical side and also on the advocacy side. And we're a small entity. We're not one of these large, you know, we're not a UN agency, and we're not a large, you know, think tank. We're a relatively small team, and we're working with many data producers and data collectors to try to bring people together to convene partnerships where we see that there might be a need to get people around the table with each other and enable that to happen. But in some cases, we also are providing technical input or technical expertise or commentary on, you know, a given, you know, design challenge. We also, on the advocacy side, and this is a relatively new area for us, we really are trying to deepen our work in advocacy as we move forward because, you know, as I said at the top of the podcast, when we started out, we really were focused on, let's define the gaps in the first place. Let's do that, you know, kind of scholarship work and sit down and do that desk review and put all of that information together into one place. And then let's start trying to get, you know, technical partnerships together to address those gaps. But it doesn't stop there. You can have technical solutions, but if you don't have the mechanisms to translate those technical solutions into a format that a policymaker can use and act upon to improve policy, then, you know, we won't have fully achieved, you know, the circle that we're trying to draw here. And so we are making, you know, really starting, we started last year, but this year it will be intensifying more, really more of a concerted effort around advocacy, which is going to include certainly, you know, education work like, you know, what we're doing right now of having conversations, hopefully reaching new communities of people to care about this and pay attention to it in their own work. But also, you know, really trying to ensure that these gender data solutions that we're working on through our partnerships are, and not only through our partnerships, but what we're hearing about from, you know, other people's work, that that's highlighted and understood and being maintained as a topic at the highest levels of political discourse. Because ultimately, at the end of the day, one of the big things that is obviously needed is investment in data collection and investment in gender data collection.
Right.
One of the challenges, you know, one of the areas, one of the reasons why, you know, we don't have great data, you know, where some of the biggest data gaps are in countries where there's the least amount of money for data collection, but those also happen to be countries where gender inequities are the most stark. And so there really needs to be a global level commitment to the importance of development data collection writ large. But within that, the understanding and the awareness and the vigilance, frankly, about the importance of keeping our eye on gender data and understanding that, you know, what's required for good gender data isn't business as usual. It's really examining our biases and asking questions differently and analyzing and using that data appropriately.
Yeah, so I think, you know, there could be a big moment for you guys here now. So International Women's Day, March 8th. So the theme, Women in the Changing World of Work. I think this ties into everything you've been talking about here. March 13th, the UN Commission on the Status of Women. So that's happening, focusing on women's economic empowerment in the changing world of work. You know, I think there's a little bit of a convergence here and possibly a big moment for Meta 2X. So, you know, I'd like to hear a little bit about what you'd have to say about that and just in general, you know, I guess a continuation of what you've been discussing here, that gender data does indeed tie into women's economic empowerment.
Yeah, and I mean, it absolutely does. I think, you know, women's economic empowerment has really caught on as a major topic of interest, as well it should. You know, I think, you know, historically, perhaps a lot of development action on women was focused in health and education arenas where we undoubtedly will always need it and mm-hmm. still need it. But, you know, that was a bit, you know, maybe not at the exclusion of, but was not, you know, the action was not always taking into account women's economic participation. And so it's really exciting to see that. And you know, incidentally, you know, our same team who started Data2X was also the team working on women's economic empowerment. And we did a lot of research to that effect. And we put out a report a few years ago. It was in 2013. It's called A Roadmap for Promoting Women's Economic Empowerment, which I think is really very relevant still today in terms of the way that it defined the problem and really kind of looked at what seemed to be the most promising and proven approaches for empowering women economically. And I think the gender data issue is hugely relevant within women's economic empowerment. You know, as we've discussed, it's one of the areas where we have some of the biggest gender data gaps is in the mm-hmm. realm of women's economic participation. And also it's one of the areas where, you know, the reasons behind why we have those data gaps has a lot to do with ingrained bias, you know, mm-hmm. and those are kind of pernicious challenges that, you know, we have to continue to highlight as not only as Data2X, but all of us and to really understand and to see how, you know, if we aren't changing the way that we collect information about how women participate in the economy, we could be making mistakes, right? So mm-hmm. we have this, what I mean by that is that we have this political moment. It's fantastic that this issue is being highlighted at global levels and that there's so much energy behind it. But you can see how, you know, you could have instances where, a government can say, okay, you know, we really want to focus on empowering women economically and getting them into the workforce. So what we need to do is, you know, invest in training programs for women in order to get them into the economy. Well, maybe that assumption is happening because we would assume, because there isn't good data on this, that, you know, women aren't already doing a lot of things in the economy, you know, mm-hmm. Which is how it would appear in a lot of places because they're not turning up in those formal statistics. But in reality, a woman is producing food for her family, which has an economic benefit, right? It's an unpaid work benefit, but it's happening. In addition to the food that she's producing on her farm for her family, some of that food on the farm is going to the market for sale, but that's, you know, informal work, not easily captured in terms mm-hmm. of, you know, her participation in the market economy. At the same time, she's caring for her children and perhaps for some elderly relatives, which has an economic and societal value and benefit, but it's not, you know, captured as such. So she's doing all of these things, right, which are a form of participation in the economy. But if you planned a training program for her to, you know, to attend, when would she do that? When would she mm-hmm. possibly have time to go to a training right. program? So the assumption might be, well, let's put some resources into a training program to get more women in the economy, and then no one comes. And then, you know, and then what's the result? So if you rewound that, you know, scenario and you had better data about how women are already participating in the economy or ways that it could be better, you know, where you could kind of, you know, adjust her scenario so that she can participate more in the formal economy, you would be making much different investments. You might be making investments in childcare. You might be making investments in, you know, well, how do we improve the you know, the seeds that she has for her family farm. You know, how do we give her more productive assets, you know, a piece of farming equipment that would increase her yield, you know, that kind of thing. It could be the same dollar amount of investment or, you know, some different dollar level of investment, but a more targeted investment based on good data that has the same end result and ultimately a better end result for women's participation.
Yeah, and so that leads me also to ask that, you know, this probably crosses over into other areas as well. You know, do you find yourself, you know, sort of crossing paths with people that are sort of fighting this fight for, like, based on maybe race or some other line where there's also inequality?
Absolutely. I think this is a much broader issue around, you know, what we would call disaggregation across several different categories. And so race and ethnicity is certainly a huge factor here, and understanding the intersection of what, you know, we would call the intersectionality of different characteristics. Age is another one. We certainly, you know, focus on age in terms of girls and women, but, you know, there's been certainly a significant push going on in terms of making sure that information about older people is being captured in data collection in a way that it hasn't been previously. So, you know, this is undoubtedly, you know, not only an issue of, you know, of just gender, but of other areas as well, and we're very much in support of that. And, you know, and I think, you know, this is also an area where I think they're on this question of greater disaggregation and understanding more. You know, one of the things that is hard sometimes about disaggregation when you're talking about statistics is that it requires such large sample sizes in terms of getting all the disaggregation characteristics that you're looking for, right? And so that's a technical challenge that also has pretty significant financial implications to it as well, right? So so I think that's sometimes a challenge. It's a real challenge. I think we're up to the challenge, you know, and there's a lot of smart people in this world that are focused on this and working on it. But I also think it's an area where it's really interesting, and it's something that we're focused on as well, of trying to understand what, you know, new data sources or different kinds of data sources can tell us about communities in a more granular way, you know, in a more real-time way as well. And so I think it's being open to both of those, you know, being open to not only improving official and traditional sources of statistics, but also on how we utilize new data sources and technologies as well.
Yeah, actually, I was going to ask about that as well, that, you know, cell phones, for example, and, you know, as more people, as more and more individuals have them, that ends up being, you know, the way to reach people, because, you know, all of the examples that you give, it just, a lot of times it leads back to, well, we can't reach these people, or we don't know how to reach them, and that's why they're not surfacing. And so, you know, I guess, you know, the increasing number of people that have cell phones, that ends up being one of the platforms. So, you know, I'm glad you mentioned technology there. So, you know, is that something that's being leveraged, or are there other sort of technology trends that you find are being leveraged so that you can reach the right people?
Yeah, I mean, so absolutely. I think it's both utilizing technology as a form of data collection, but you're right, you very importantly point out it's also, you know, certainly an important platform for then reaching people with, you know, a programmatic message or a policy message or, you know, things like that as well. And we absolutely are, you know, I think this is an area where we are seeing advancements in terms of tools for capturing gaps in data that might be missed by conventional data sources. So, you know, for example, using things like satellite imagery and, you know, call detail records, credit card transactions, Facebook and Twitter, you know, and social media posts, We actually have what I think is going to be an exciting new report on big data and the well-being of women and girls, and it's going to be coming out on March 21st. And so definitely follow us on Twitter at Data2X to have more information, because we're planning to e-launch the report. And so I think it's going to be really exciting. You know, when we started looking into big data as an area just of interest to us when we started writing and about data gaps back in 2013, you know, there really was not anything out there. A lot of people were certainly talking a lot and doing amazing things mm-hmm. in terms of big data for development overall, but gender as a topic as a unit of analysis, you know, really wasn't part of that dialogue at the time. And so we, you know, with the support of our funders, put some energy and financing behind that to do a series of pilots on really trying to figure out what big data could help us, could help tell us in terms of women and girls, and really closing some of those gender data gaps. So we're really excited about this report, and would love for you, Jamie, and for everyone listening to this podcast to go and check it out and spread the word.
That's great. Yeah, that sounds awesome. So is there anything else that you'd want to add? You know, what does the, you know, next couple of years look like, and, you know, anything else that we should keep our eyes open for?
Yeah, so the next couple of years I think are going to be really, really exciting. You know, we've spent time building, you know, these partnerships in a variety of areas. Big data, which I just talked about, has been one. Women's economic empowerment has been another. And we have several others on a variety of topics. So I would say, you know, please continue to follow our work and see, you know, what advancements our partners have been able to make. But also in terms of following the chain of people starting to really wake up to this topic of gender data and start to take action. And I'm really hoping that what we see is higher level and greater level policy commitments and financial commitments to gender data, you know, as a topic for both collection and analysis and use. I'm really hoping that what not only Data2X is able to create, but others are able to create as well, is just a higher level of dialogue of really the kind of the so what question of, mm-hmm. okay, so we have this gender data, what does it do for us? You know, continuing to tease that out is going to be a big area of focus for us. And a big area of tracking for us, too, because I think that there are probably areas where it has had an impact that just haven't gotten as much conversation and dialogue about them. So that will be, I think, another really important area for us. Certainly, seeing what the effect of more attention and thought of gender data and gender data collection will have in the process of monitoring the Sustainable Development Goals, I think mm-hmm. that's going to be really important, an important theme to watch. And I'm excited to see, you know, what that might tell us about, you know, our level of achievements vis-a-vis the Sustainable Development Goals. And, you know, I think, you know, last part, just to bridge back to a question you asked earlier about disaggregation, what I'm hoping, too, is that, you know, this focus on gender data and what I oftentimes think of, you know, that gender data seems like this complicated thing, and it's not without its complications. But my premise is that, you know, this is a community of people who are incredibly smart and creative, and I think we're up to this challenge. And if we're up to the gender data challenge, then we're up to the challenge for several other categories of differences in terms of age and disability and race and ethnicity. We're up to all of those challenges of having greater information about all different groups of people, especially people who have traditionally been excluded from some of our data collection methods. And I think what I'm hopeful for is that, you know, this gender data movement might be kind of a proof case for mm-hmm. how we can do this, how we can leverage, you know, political will, creativity, technical smarts and abilities to really solve this problem, and that it might provide some really great clues for solving some of these other challenges as well.
That's great. That's an inspirational note to end on. Emily, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. This is I love this topic. You know, one of the reasons is that it's both like a root cause to certain things, and then it's also, like you talked about, the measurement angle here and measuring progress. And so reminding everyone we have to measure properly here to learn root causes of things, to put policy into action, and to measure any kind of progress we're making. So thanks for enlightening us today. I really appreciate it.
Absolutely. And thank you so much for having us and for being gender data revolutionaries with us.
Well, now I am. For our listeners, I hope you enjoyed this episode of Champions to Social Good. To learn more about Data2X, you can visit data2x.org, follow at Data2X on Twitter, and you can also follow Emily at Emily C. Pryor. You can also find Data2X actively engaged in Twitter discussions using hashtag gender data. Make sure to subscribe to the podcast so you don't miss an episode. And keep up with the conversation between episodes by following us on Twitter at Jamie Serino and MicroEdge LLC and at Fatbot. Thank you for listening.